This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
So before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God help me. And then I lost consciousness, and then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife.
It wasn't then, but now lucky Louis Zamperini is experiencing the afterlife with the book Unbroken and then the Hollywood film of the same name. Louis is certainly the most well-known of the dozens of ex-prisoners of war who have shared their stories on Hometown Heroes. By the way, a movie sequel is now in production. It's going to pick up the Olympian-turned-POW story where the Unbroken film left off, and it'll detail Louis' experience and exploits after emerging from captivity. I'll let you know when it's hitting theaters, but the working title is Unbroken: Path to Redemption. And remember, you can always access the interview we did with Louis at hometownheroesradio.com. This weekend marks National POW MIA Recognition Day, and I trust this program will serve as a reminder for you to pause and remember. If you happen to be in California and you can make plans for next weekend, I've been invited to speak next Saturday evening, September 23rd, in Bakersfield, California, at an annual event there to remember the missing and honor ex-POWs. At least four former prisoners of war will be there, including 102-year-old Jack Schwartz, who, like Louis Zamperini, was a prisoner of the Japanese. Jack was captured on Guam the day after the war began, and he wouldn't taste freedom again for 1,367 days, not until a couple weeks after the Japanese surrendered.
We never thought that we would win a war eventually, even though things were bad. And we didn't know how long it would take. The Japanese called it a 100 years war because what they called it the Eastern China Co-Prosperity Sphere. That's what they called it, and which meant that they were going to take over China and all the Orient, really. And we knew it would be that long, obviously. But there was no idea of how long it would take. And I think some died from discouragement. I really do, because we all had the same amount of food, and some just sort of gave up. In one of the camps I was at, I was in Yokohama for 2 years after, not at first. We lost about one man a month, I think just from discouragement. They had to work, but they all worked. The officers, incidentally, were not put to work. I think that's the only thing of the Geneva Conference that the Japs honored. I never knew why, but they did. They made us promise not to escape. Well, that was easy. Where we could escape to another island. Actually, it would have been easy to escape from the camp. But where do you go? You're an American in Japan. Who's not going to recognize you? And a few people did try to escape. They got caught the next day and brought back. Then the whole camp suffered. We had to stand at attention for all night long or something like that.
You mentioned guys dying from discouragement. So that begs the question, what kept you encouraged? What helped you believe that you would survive, that you would get home to see your wife again?
I'm not sure. I just think we have faith that we'd get recaptured. I mean, there's no doubt about it, we'd win the war eventually. As I've said, fortunately, I was not ever really sick. And we all lost weight, but we all wanted more food, but it wasn't to the point where we were emaciated. So just had faith, that was all.
And I want to talk to you about some of the conditions of the camps you're in and the way you were treated and what you had to eat and all that. But as far as communicating with your wife back home, was there a point at which you were able to get a letter to her and vice versa? Or were you guys without communication that whole time?
No, actually, we did get to, it was 3 or 4 months after we were captured that the U.S. was notified who the prisoners were. So at least the family knew I was alive. It was quite a bit of time after that when we were each allowed to write a postcard home, which of course was censored, but anyhow, we did write home. And in the course of the whole war, I probably wrote 4 or 5 postcards and got a few letters. I got one package from home. That was about the extent of communication. At least they knew we were alive. And the Red Cross sent packages now and then, but in my almost four years, I got one package. And there were more deaths than Jeff's was confiscated, that was all. We got the package, of course, it was a big deal. It had, among other things, butter and jam and some meat. And of all things, a package of cigarettes. And I don't smoke then. I didn't smoke now. And so trading went on. I traded a pack of cigarettes for a jar of jam, as I recall it. There wasn't all that much communication, but it was good having even some.
And I'm sure that each camp was different. But when you think back on it all that time, what were the most difficult things that you had to deal with? Were you treated well? Were you abused? How would you describe the way you were handled as a prisoner by your Japanese captors?
Well, the first camp at Sensuji turned out to be just an officer's camp. And the Japanese used that for their show camp. If the Red Cross wanted to inspect a Japanese POW camp, they went to Sensuji. It was practically a country club compared to other camps. So there you have to say that outside of not eating enough, we were not abused, really. In fact, they tried to teach us Japanese, but they gave up after a while. Of course, we learned some things. You had to count off ichi, ni, san, chi, and so forth. And we learned the commands, turn right, turn left, sit down, you know, things like that. And a little Japanese. But here's something that's interesting. Once in a while, we got Japanese newspapers printed in English. Of course, this was near the beginning of the war. The Japs were winning all over the place. But we got the news anyway. And even a couple of years later, when I got back to Sensuji, we got one or two copies. And by then, of course, they were losing the war, and their reporting was quite a bit different. All in all, I've said ever since I came back that as POWs go, I was a very lucky POW. I was beaten a few times at Kawasaki because I was the senior officer there. And if anything went wrong, they blamed me. And I'd get beaten around the face. Not wounded, really, just beaten up till you fall down and they stop. But the interesting thing is that the Japanese beat their own soldiers. A corporal could beat up a private. Just a different culture, that's all. So I'll say again, not only lucky to get back, I was lucky the way I was treated, really.
Because in general, Japanese prisoners of the Japanese in World War II had a lot rougher circumstances in most cases than prisoners of the Germans did. But you look at even the longest held POW of the war in Japan, you feel like you were fortunate over there. Were you aware that others in Japanese captivity were being treated in worse shape than you were?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we got stories about them. And, of course, I've read many stories about them since then. This was not in Sensuji, but I went to Kawasaki after about 6 months, along with the other two civil engineers from Guam, and we never knew why. And we guess it was because they shipped some Navy machinists up there. Maybe they thought engineers were machinists. Anyhow, when we got up, I said, oh, it's a mistake. We'll send you back. Well, they sent my friend Frank back after a year, and they sent me back after 2 years, and the third one stayed there through the whole war, and he was killed by American planes about 2 weeks before the war was over. I mean, Bob had hit the cab. So he lived through the whole war and never got home. So as I say, here I was lucky.
And I imagine when you hear a story like that, when you get that news, there's part of you that says, hey, that could have been me.
Well, sure, it could have been. Here's the other thing I was about to tell you. Up at this camp in Kawasaki, we had an English doctor. He was in the English Navy. How he got there is a different story, which you don't want to know about. But he treated the American prisoners, and he got beat up more than I did because he kept on trying to get prisoners' excuse of going to work. If he tried so hard, he'd get beaten up. He still kept it up. He lived through the war, and later on in 1946, I sent him packages because in England, they were really hard up for months after the war was over. So he got care packages from me as a return favor. But as I say, I've always said I was lucky.
You wouldn't recommend being a POW for almost 4 years?
That's exactly right.
But that said, I imagine there's a lot of perspective that you've carried forward in your life that you wouldn't have if you had not endured all those years without the freedom that you treasure so much now.
I think so, because things that many people take real serious, and by comparison, they're not serious. And that's been my attitude really long.
Did you ever make friends with any of the Japanese guards or soldiers or officers?
Yes, I did. We had an interpreter at this second cabin in Kawasaki. I forget his first name. His name was Kondo. And we got quite friendly, really. And in fact, he treated us pretty well. We talked, and I had learned in prison camp to do a macrame. I don't know if you know what that is.
Sure.
We got a hold of the string, and I was making microwave wristbands. And the condo says, hey, make me one. I said, what are you going to do for me? And I knew what I wanted. I had seen in the papers that some bookstore was selling American books on calculus, and I wanted that.
You wanted a you're in captivity. Your wife's back in the States. You barely have anything to eat, and what you want to trade for is a calculus book?
Well, what else I could trade for? So I did, and he got it for me, and I worked every problem in the book. I should have saved the book, but I haven't had it. But it helped pass the time. Actually, in my situation, it was border more than anything else, because the officers didn't have to go to work. But what else was there to do? You sat around. There were only six of us there. Interesting thing, though, you were talking about attitudes. 1 year to date after the war was over, two of my friends committed suicide, two that had been in camp with me. So it did have a lasting effect on a lot of people. One was living in a room with me. He was a master sergeant from the Philippines. And the other was a Lieutenant J.G., who was captured in Guam, a very wealthy young man, too, incidentally. They committed suicide a year later, so it must have weighed on him very heavily. I was over it by then.
How'd you do that?
Heck, I don't know.
Well, I want to get to that moment of your liberation and everything that transpired from there, but you mentioned food, and I know you lost 50 pounds or so and got down to about 125, but give us a sense of what you did have to subsist on. What kind of food did they give you? And were there moments where you got something out of the ordinary that you appreciated a lot more than you might say now?
Well, basically the food was soup and rice. In fact, it wasn't always rice. As the war went on, we didn't get rice because some sorts of gravy we didn't recognize, but it was great anyhow. And the soup was mostly vegetable soup. I'm not sure if you know what a daikon is, do you? It's a huge white radish. But we had daikon soup day after day after day. And maybe once a month you'd find a tiny piece of fish or meat in it. So the only sick problem I had is I did get beriberi. And in fact, most of the prisoners got beriberi because there was not enough vitamin B in their food. And that beriberi did have an effect on me. It's affected me ever since in my life because it affected my walking. And it used to flare up and disappear. And in the last few years, it has disappeared, so my walking is terrible. And at our last camp up in Rokorochi, which is very isolated, not even a small town near it, we were up there from June until the end of the war, and the food was no better, and the barracks were even worse. I sent away not so long ago a sketch of the camp that somebody had made. It's in the POW magazines and stuff. And on the upper deck, we each had 22 inches of space. On the lower deck, we each had 25 inches of space. So that's the way it is. If the war had not stopped, we probably would have frozen up there because they got snow up there all the time, and we had nothing for that. But fortunately, the war did stop. Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, hostilities have ceased. And he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there? No guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks. And it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us. And 2 hours later, a parachute was dropping out of the camp full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much. But why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses. And this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
To kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of them anyway. And then there was... I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads, and we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy, and they put the Navy people on board the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags, and they gave us uniforms. They wore cappy uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the planes to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. What you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. And what a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us. Because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. And of course, it was nice knowing somebody. And we stayed there for about a week and sort of got used to living again. Got all uniforms. They gave us each $100, as I recall it. And finally, we all got orders and shipped home. But we went home on a naval vessel. Here again, they didn't have room, but they built shells. We were sleeping three deep on shells. But this didn't matter, because we were eating like pigs. And it took us 17 days to get home. It keeps getting funny, ha-ha. We got to San Francisco and land at Fort Mason and get off the ship. Oh, incidentally, while I was on Guam, I called my wife. I called her from Honolulu, so she was up here to meet me. What's between us and the families? A six-foot-high wooden fence. So here we are back in San Francisco. We're still prisoners.
But not for long. He would remedy that quickly, reunite with his wife, and go on to serve in the Navy until 1962. Jack is still going strong at 102, and you can link to his entire original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Even better, you can meet him in Bakersfield, California, next Saturday night if you're available. More on that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.